Beyoncé Knowles' inescapable hit song, Single Ladies. Now put your hands up in a club, just broke up, I'm doing my all the pain. The video's in black and white, Beyoncé and two other women dancing in a void. There's no set, there's no club, no crystal, no guys, just three chicks tossing their hair in almost perfect sync. But just try searching for Single Ladies on YouTube. You'll find a whole lot more than just that Beyoncé video. A veritable chorus line of homemade booty shakers. Everybody, it seems, is stealing her moves and doing them everywhere.
Wherever I can find on demand, I just watch it. Like, every day I'm trying to get better at it.
17-year-old Jasmine Burroughs, a high school student here in Washington, she rewinds the video again and again, working on her moves. She's dancing at Ronald Brown Middle School, where math teacher Patrice Billups works.
It kind of reminds me of my college dance girls. Like, the moves look just like when we have football games and the dance girls will come out. It looks just like that. So I was really excited to see it.
So how did Beyoncé come up with these infectious steps? At a Mexican breakfast. Mexican breakfast. That's the name of a 1960s Bob Fosse dance routine. Broadway's Gwen Verdon, flanked by two saucy ladies in pantsuits, on stage at the Ed Sullivan Show. Beyoncé saw this clip and an early YouTube takeoff set to the hit song Walk It Out, so the pop star decided to channel the spirit of Gwen Verdon with a sexy, updated style.
Oh my God, because they're getting down the whole time with no cuts, no let's do another take. It's just them three ladies dancing, going in for the kill, and they're jamming.
That's Beyoncé's choreographer, Jaquel Knight. He's 19. Knight took the idea and added a healthy dose of J-setting. It's a sassy, jazzy style inspired by dance teams at historically black colleges. One person does a set of moves and the others follow. The perfect style for people all over the country to pick up. And Jaquel Knight says this is exactly what he hoped for.
Just to see people wanting to learn and be able to dance now, because that's how I grew up. I grew up doing dance numbers that I've seen on TV. All of Mary J. Blige's dance numbers, all of Jodeci's, all of MC Hammer's, all of TLC's. I think that's how it should be.
And get this, Beyoncé and her dancers shot the video in one take. It took 12 hours to get it right, and many fans are spending that long watching the video over and over again, learning the moves themselves. Young, old, thin, not so thin. Everyone's doing it. Even Justin Timberlake did it on Saturday Night Live in a black leotard and heels. So turn up the radio and feel it.
From NPR News, this is Day to Day. In the summer of 1976, this band, the Ramones, played a show in London. Admission was just £1.60. Next week, however, the flyer for that show may well sell for several $1,000. It's one of hundreds of items of punk rock memorabilia that's being auctioned on Monday at Christie's Auction House in New York. We're joined now by Christie's pop culture director, Simeon Lipman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell me about some of the items that you'll have for auction on Monday.
Well, it's a really fun sale. We tried to include a little bit of everything in this sale as far as punk memorabilia goes. So we have posters, flyers, clothing, artwork, autographs. There's something for everybody.
I was looking through the online catalog for this auction, and I came across a Sears model bass guitar. It was a guitar used by Kurt Cobain of the band Nirvana, and it's listed as selling for potentially more than $60,000. In this economy, who's got the cash to pay that kind of money for a Sears bass guitar?
Well, you know, with this type of memorabilia, it's not necessarily the intrinsic value of the guitar. It's the fact that a 14-year-old Kurt Cobain is pictured playing it. This particular piece was a guitar he learned on. It's totally unique. So, you know, for that collector out there that wants something that was, you know, actually played by this iconic rock star, this is something he played and actually learned upon. It's the type of thing you can't get anywhere else, and the type of thing that is really nostalgia driven, and a lot of this memorabilia falls into that category.
In the original days of punk rock back in the 70s, it wasn't just about music. It was a movement, and that movement was very anti-establishment. It was totally against corporate culture. Doesn't it seem a bit ironic to you that now these items are being sold for profit?
Well, you know, we're not trying to make any statements here. We're just trying to offer the collectors out there an opportunity to obtain something that they might not have been able to obtain 30 years ago, and certainly are not able to obtain, you know, readily today. You know, this material was never really meant to be held on to. It's ephemeral by nature. It's paper, it's flyers, it's posters. These are things that mom threw out when you went away to college, you know, similar to baseball cards and comic books and things like that. And you know, the fact that these pieces survived make them very special and really generate a lot of nostalgia amongst collectors. And that's why we like to offer stuff like this.
Do you have a personal favorite item amongst this collection?
Oh, I have a lot of favorite items. it's a lot of fun being able to you know, curate a sale like this and amass this wonderful material. I love the original album cover art for License to Ill, the Beastie Boys' first album. I mean, that was so influential in my life. You know, I remember as a kid playing that album over and over and over again and staring at the cover, and here is the actual artwork for that. So that was kind of a thrill.
Simeon Lippman is the chief of pop culture at Christie's Auction House in New York. Thank you.
Thank you. Hold it now.
If you want to see some of the items up for auction at Christie's, including the portable organ John Lennon once played at Shea Stadium, go to our website, npr.org/daytoday.
They look just like telephone booths, but they're decorated with hands folded in prayer, and there's a place to kneel. The booths are an art installation designed to get people to discuss prayer. You can find these prayer booths in Jackson, Tennessee, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and now in New York, where NPR's Margo Adler found them in a bustling Manhattan street.
You couldn't find a place less conducive to meditation than this corner of 60th Street, where cars are streaming east toward the 59th Street Bridge or down 2nd Avenue, and yet there are two prayer booths here a block apart. I'm surprised to see Ken Bronstein, the president of New York City Atheists, checking them out.
So you just happened to be walking by at this very moment.
At this exact moment. But I always keep my eyes and ears open.
And what Bronstein says is art smart. This is prayer in a public place.
As an atheist, when you talk about prayer, you're talking to a supernatural situation. And we say there's no supernatural, so that definitely puts in a religious category. That, to me, is the line. You know, if they want to put in private property, that's where it should go, but not in public space.
I watch for an hour. No one prays. One person snaps a picture of the booth, another comments sadly that there's graffiti on one. Francesca Richardson says she gets by on disability payments. She notes not many people come up to the booths.
It's almost like they're walking around it like, what is this thing? It's a mystery.
Not for her, though. She remembers she was on her way to the bank.
And praying on the way over.
She really needed this check to clear. First it didn't, then it did. Then she walked outside.
Saw the prayer booth, went over to it, was curious, opened it up.
Did you kneel?
Yes, I did. And I was just praying for gratitude and thanks. That's all I'm going to say is I believe.
And she is not unique. Avery Williams is 7 years old.
Well, my gerbil died, so we prayed for him. And my dog had a very bad leg, so we prayed for that too.
The artist Dylan Mortimer, who says he is a person of faith, designed these prayer booths as part of the city's Arts in the Park program to start a dialogue about public prayer.
The piece sparks a wide range of reactions, from people loving it to people hating it to people threatening me to people, I mean, it's kind of all over the board.
He says prayer is a really difficult topic, especially in a city like New York. It's a loaded topic, causes divisions. But let's face it, he says, people could be praying anywhere, sitting down, standing up, or walking, or running. And of course, it's true. All you have to do is ride the New York City subways to see Jewish men davening over prayer books, Catholic women saying the rosary, and lots of people doing who knows what, eyes closed, hands folded, as Dylan Mortimer puts it.
Perhaps the scary reality is there could be people praying all around you. And that's sort of the point.
Although others would argue that what people do privately is not the same thing as having something out there in public, even if it's art. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. Hollywood is bracing for another possible strike. Talks between the Actors Union and the studio executives resume today. They met for more than 12 hours yesterday. There was a federal mediator there, and yet they were unable to come up with an agreement.
We're joined now by NPR correspondent Kim Masters. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Alex.
Kim, remind us why the Screen Actors Guild and the studios haven't been able to see eye to eye.
Well, the big fight is how actors will be compensated for work in new media. They want jurisdiction and they want a piece of the pie. And the great backdrop against which this happened is that the entire Hollywood working community felt that they were shortchanged when DVDs came into play. They didn't get a big enough piece of that pie. A lot of people have said they don't want to be burned again. The studios take the position that this is still a very new and not particularly lucrative media and that they need time and they're not going to start cutting in the actors and on that big of a piece at this point. And they point out that every other union that takes residuals has settled for an existing deal that the writers took and that the directors took. The Screen Actors Guild, which has very aggressive leadership, is the last holdout.
So what do you think? Are we headed towards a strike?
You know, it would seem intuitively impossible in this environment that the actors would want to go on strike at this point. Just factoring out for a second the economy, there was a devastating writer's strike, and people were just really tired of that by the time it was over. Now, meanwhile, people are watching their savings disappear. It's terrifying out there, and I can't imagine that people would want to go on strike. But you have to bear in mind that a great many members in the Screen Actors Guild don't really work and can vote. So that might have an effect on the outcome.
You mentioned the writer's strike that went on for several months. Many folks in the entertainment industry are still recovering from that. So what would happen if all of a sudden there were a SAG strike as well?
The studios can hold out. They're in bad shape. I mean, they're going to be hurt by this environment economically. But that doesn't mean they can't survive for quite a long time with a strike underway. And that means that people would, I mean, it would just be so devastating. People would lose their jobs, and that wouldn't just be the actors. It would be people who support productions. The actors, unlike the writers, they can close down a movie very quickly. So it would be an immediate and potentially a long-term and a devastating impact, not only for the economy here, but for the Screen Actors Guild if it turned out to backfire.
So, Kim, what happens from here? What's the next steps?
At some point, they can declare an impasse, and the Screen Actors Guild will go to its members and ask for strike authorization. That requires 75% approval of those voting. There certainly are some very high-profile actors, George Clooney, Tom Hanks, who are very opposed to this and who probably would go out there and try to persuade people to vote and vote it down. But with 75% approval of those voting, not of the membership, of those voting, that would mean they would have strike authorization and they could initiate a strike.
And if there is a strike, what would that mean for viewers? Does that mean even more hours of reality TV?
AFTRA, which is the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, which I should mention represents those of us at NPR, will make probably great strides signing up more TV shows in primetime than they've had in the past because they have already made a deal with the studios and they will sell themselves as the more reasonable alternative to SAG. So there may be some disruption. I think movies, there will certainly be no impact felt for quite a long time. Movies take a long time to make and the studios have stuff in the pipeline. And there may be some disruption in terms of television, but I think in terms of who can hold out the longest, clearly the studios have the upper hand.
NPR's Kim Masters, thanks so much.
Thank you.